Welcome to Focus Black Oklahoma. I'm Ariel Davis.
And I'm Colby Webster. In our first story, we learn what Hunger Free Oklahoma is doing to keep children across the state fed amongst the many disruptions of the COVID-19 crisis. Executive Director Chris Bernard takes us through the connections from food insecurity to the school-to-prison pipeline, health outcomes, college and career readiness, and disease prevention.
Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
So just to start off, for our listeners who may not be familiar with your organization, what is the mission of Hunger Free Oklahoma? What do you do?
Sure. So our mission is to leverage the power of collaboration to improve systems, practices, and policies, all focused towards ending hunger in Oklahoma. We are about 3 years old. We started with just two of us with some seed funding from the Ann Henry Zero Foundation, headquartered here in Tulsa. And we are now a staff of 13 with offices both in Tulsa and Oklahoma City, really working statewide to build capacity of organizations, communities, government agencies, school districts to leverage the resources that are already out there and available to them to better fight food insecurity. So a lot of those are federal resources, but we also try and work with the charitable side and help make sure that resources are working in the most effective and efficient way possible and getting directly to the folks who need them.
So with that efficiency, it was just announced that Oklahoma schools will remain closed through April 6th. How many students are you thinking who will be left without meals that usually get them at school? And how is Hunger Free Oklahoma helping getting meals to those students?
Yeah, so in Oklahoma, the number of kids who are on free and reduced lunch is over 400,000. And just because they're not on free and reduced lunch doesn't really mean that their families don't rely on access to those meals, right? It's a fairly low income bar, but we also have a lot of schools that feed kids universally for free, whether they meet those requirements or not. For instance, Tulsa Public Schools feeds all their elementary students for free via this federal mechanism that allows them to do that. So that's a lot of kids, right? And it's not just the kids. When we're talking about schools shutting down, a lot of these families, the parents are hourly workers, right? Some of them might be working at the schools. Some of them are working at restaurants, bars, hotels. All of those places are going to see their business disintegrate or at least shrink considerably during this time. And for that, they're going to have to cut hours or lay off staff. So we're going to see those families struggling even more than normal, right? They're not going to have access to the resources they normally would. So we have to think beyond just the kids and how do we try and wrap around sort of a package of resources that, you know, in my world, it's food insecurity, but we need to think broader than that as a community of what other areas are we going to need to support these families in.
So the school closing announcement came out March 16th. How long has Hunger Free Oklahoma been working to make sure if the schools were to close that students will be able to receive free meals?
So we've been thinking about it for at least a month now, right? And when I say thinking about it, it's talking to the important players who can make decisions that allow the resources to flow in. So that's the USDA that controls a lot of these federal programs. It's the state departments who administer them. So that's Department of Human Services, State Department of Ed, and the State Department of Health. And talking to some of the key stakeholders like the food banks, who are a huge portion of this response, what they're thinking, what their capacity would be. We all kind of thought about it just like the teacher walkout a few years ago, and we pulled together pretty well, right? We helped coordinate the response in the Tulsa area. United Way really kind of did the overlapping umbrella to bring different services together. But this is a totally different monster, right? You can't, for instance, in that time, we found sites where we could provide childcare for huge groups of kids. You can't do that in this situation. And the number you can have together is shrinking like by the hour almost. I think we're down to 10 now. So we've been thinking about it, but I would say we are still preparing and we are still planning because it changes so rapidly. And each response or new rule changes the way you have to approach getting the resources to people or getting people to the resources.
And you're referring to COVID-19, which I think we haven't mentioned yet because it's kind of everywhere and almost right. Ubiquitous even now. So it's like even before COVID, you've been doing this prep work with the teacher walkouts. And I guess there hasn't been much since 3 years before that.
No, but there's been a lot of movement towards collaboration, right? So I mentioned that was our mission. So we have a statewide collaborative that includes a lot of these stakeholders that think about child food insecurity, focusing on expanding summer meal access because we're the worst in the nation at kids accessing summer meals generally, but that's the same sort of principle. We make people aware of a resource that's available to them in a time where another resource has been taken away. So school meals in this case, right? And summer meals is the normal response. And that's actually the response school districts are being allowed to implement during this closure. They operate as if it's summer, and the waivers they're getting, so federal waivers kind of waive normal rules, right? So our State Department of Ed applied for waivers to waive the congregate meal requirement. So normally the kids would have to stay there and all eat together. That's not going to be the case. They'll be able to grab the meal and go. There's also 3 waivers now, and I bet we would see more that are pending that would waive some of these other rules, like only serving low-income areas. So right now it's limited to districts that have 50% or more free and reduced lunch. In Oklahoma, that's a majority of districts, but it's not all of them, right? There could be waivers that would allow the food banks and some other folks to respond for a third meal in the day because summer only covers 2 meals. There's a lot of possibilities there. We're hoping to see some waivers even where kids could take more than one meal home, so they only have to go to that site once a day instead of for each meal. Lots of possibilities, and we're sort of looking to some of the other states that are further along in the outbreak and what they're doing to try and kind of mine their best practices and learn from their mistakes and figure out what the model here should look like.
So it's fascinating that you're creating this resilient model to make sure that kids get fed no matter what. But Oklahoma has so many school districts, and I'm curious what partners you're working with to keep this resilient infrastructure in place.
It kind of varies, right? So we have statewide partners. We work really closely with the departments that kind of cover the whole state. We work really closely with the 2 food banks. So there's one Tulsa Community Food Bank of Eastern Oklahoma, one in Oklahoma City called the Regional Food Bank of Oklahoma. Together, they cover the whole state. And they not only do like your traditional pantry work that I think most people think of, but they provide summer meals. They provide after school meals, and they access some of those USDA dollars to do that just like schools do. We engage with the largest school districts pretty easily, right? So TPS, we're a very close partner with. Oklahoma City Public Schools, we work closely with. But then we try and access, because we don't have enough staff to cover every district, what we try and do is access sort of associations that can cover that, so superintendents, associations. We work closely with community-based organizations that have a broader footprint, like the YMCAs of Oklahoma, Boys and Girls Clubs. We work closely with tribes. Chickasaw Nation's a huge partner of ours. You're always making connections, right? And you're trying to weave, just like we're trying to weave a safety net of all these resources, we're trying to weave a network in the state where everyone is on the same page and responding in time. So to do that as well, we have to produce trainings or one-pagers and sort of guides for districts to access that we do via outreach and, you know, hopefully other people promote them that say, here are some best practices at how you do this. We're not going to be able to be in every community, but one of the kind of beauties of smaller communities, honestly, the rural areas, even without many resources, they can get together very quickly and figure out how to pool them. So often where we can help them, it's not about connecting them with people in their community, right? They know that. It's about telling them what resources they can tap into that are coming from the feds or the state to really support their work.
Shifting focus a little bit from the people who are on the front lines combating food insecurity, I want to talk for a second about the people who are facing food insecurity. Mm-hmm. Who are those people? Do they live in specific areas or neighborhoods?
They're really everywhere. You have concentrated pockets of poverty for sure, right? So an easy one that everyone's going to think of is the north side of Tulsa, right? You have a lot of food insecure folks there. But also on the west side of Tulsa, east side of Tulsa, a group called Data Pioneers just did some work with the Food Security Coalition that we sort of staff in Tulsa and figured out that one of the biggest pockets of folks who are in poverty but not accessing SNAP, which is our biggest food insecurity resource, is actually in South Tulsa, right? So they're the folks living in some of these apartments that are surrounded by middle-income, high-income folks. But because of that, they're also further away from a lot of the social services or, you know, DHS offices, because those places are put in some of the higher areas of poverty. Rurally, you know, it's all over. And it's not always folks who are low income, right? It might be a family who's experiencing crisis, whether that be high medical bills, you know, or one of the family members gets laid off, a car wreck, an accident, whatever it is. Food insecurity can impact you regardless of your income. It just happens to be higher associated with poverty.
So I assume there are a lot of metrics that tie into the benefits of having food. And I'm really curious if you have those memorized and can kind of list those off for us.
I'm not sure I have them all memorized, but I can help you, right? So actually what attracted me to this job, because my career is not in food insecurity. My career is actually in deeper systems work, criminal justice and juvenile justice reform, and HIV and drug abuse work. But what's really cool about an issue like food insecurity or other basic needs work is it's foundational, right? So we know that lots of folks who live in different situations have a lot of risk factors, and then they need protective factors, right? Food insecurity is a huge risk factor. It puts you at risk of worse health outcomes. Kids who are food insecure are less likely to score well in reading and math. They're less likely to graduate. They're less likely to move on to college. But when you connect them with these resources, we see those change dramatically. So you can actually, there was a study done in North Carolina on some schools that were high poverty, right? And if you looked at kids' test scores, at the beginning and middle of the month, they were pretty high scoring. At the end of the month, their grades dropped, I think, by 10%. SNAP benefits, which, like I said, are the biggest benefit to address food insecurity, come in usually at the beginning or middle of the month. They are usually gone by the end of the month because they're supplemental, right? They're not meant to pay for a whole grocery budget. SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's what most people refer to as food stamps, but we changed that name a while ago, right? That is a huge resource. It's supplemental. It doesn't cover the whole grocery budget for a family, and that's why we see it run out at the end, right? Especially as families are making tough decisions of repair my car to get me to work or pay for the groceries. So we can directly tie food insecurity and some other basic needs into lots of positive or negative outcomes for families and for individuals. And we can even tie it into children who are on SNAP are less likely to be on SNAP as adults versus their peers who are in the same poverty situation but were not on SNAP are more likely to be on SNAP as adults. Across the board, it's better outcomes if folks have the food and nutrition they need. Just think about a kid in school who's hungry, right? That kid's not focusing. They're not learning. They're going to have more behavioral issues. And if you want to talk about like an issue close to the mission of your show, right? Like if you've got a kid who's acting up, they're more likely to be suspended, expelled, right? You're moving right into the school to prison pipeline. Right. And we know that's going to impact certain kids more than others.
So thinking of those kids, where can people pick up meals?
It's going to vary by communities. What we know right now is Tulsa Public Schools plans to have meal sites at every school they have. So they will be producing meals and kids can walk either into the school. Hopefully a model that will be adopted is actually almost like a drive-through model to reduce contact and risk, right? And as this process plays through, some schools might not have many kids come. But we also have a lot of community partners who are eager to help. So we're going to try and work together with stakeholders to say, where are there places that we know are going to have transportation barriers that a school is not close to? And how do we use a community partner, whether it be a church or a park or whatever, to have a site there? There's even models that we've seen that I can't guarantee TPS will do, but models in other states where they're driving school buses around with meals and hitting bus stops that would be on the normal school route, because we know those kids are close to that, right? Because that's where they get their bus in the first place. So I think we'll be testing it out collaboratively at the beginning, but I can say for sure confidently in Tulsa it'll be in schools. In any community that the school district is able to utilize the waivers and feed kids, it could differ based on their knowledge of that community and where they think families are likely to go. But we're going to do our best. We have a map we use for summer meals. It's geolocated. It shows you every site in the entire state, where you can get it, when you can get it, et cetera. We're going to adapt that to do these same meals. And we hope, as long as we have good data sharing with the State Department, that'll be real-time accurate.
Is that on the website or?
Yeah, so it's mealsforkidsok.org is that site. Our site is hungerfreeok.org.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Glad to have you.
Thank you.
With the Tulsa Race Massacre centennial anniversary on the horizon and Mayor G.T. Bynum's commitment to uncover the mass graves that resulted from the massacre, many Tulsans are experiencing polarized responses for how the city can move forward in a way that honors descendants in Black Tulsans who live with the aftermath of a destroyed community. Crystal Patrick has the story.
The 100-year centennial of the Tulsa Race Massacre is just over a year away. On May 31, 1921, mobs of white residents attacked black businesses and homes in the Greenwood District. Black Wall Street, as it was called, was one of the most prosperous African-American communities in the United States. It has been called the single worst incident of racial violence in American history. 35 city blocks of black-owned businesses and homes were looted and burned to the ground. Along with the destruction of hundreds of businesses and homes, an estimated 300 people were killed by the violence. Today, only one original structure stands. The historic Vernon AME Church sits in the heart of the Greenwood District. I sat down with Reverend Robert Turner, who is the lead pastor of the church.
Vernon, we started in 1905, second oldest predominantly black church in Tulsa. 1905, we worshiped in one of our members' living room. And then 1906, came down here to Gurley Hall. 1908, we left Gurley Hall. O.W. Gurley, one of the founders of Black Wall Street, and came and got a parcel of land, 307 North Greenwood, and built our first sanctuary. And in 1919, we had the basement, which would serve as the foundation to what we called at that time our superstructure.
There are eyewitness accounts that private aircraft dropped homemade bombs, one of which caused severe damage to the structure of Vernon AME, but left the original basement intact.
And the basement was built in 1919, and 1921 we had begun to build our superstructure. On May 31st through June the 1st, 18 hours, our superstructure was destroyed through the worst race massacre in American history. And while it was not the only structure that survived the massacre, it's the only structure that survived the massacre that we still have today.
Vernon AME, like many of the businesses and homes, was insured, but all of the claims submitted by homeowners and business owners in Greenwood were denied.
And so we rebuilt on our own. We rebuilt our superstructure we had started to build. No other place helped us out. Our insurance didn't help. Neighboring community didn't help. Black folks really helped. That was it.
No other churches?
No other white churches at all. No, not at all.
Many feel as if the massacre was a land grab because of the prime real estate Greenwood was on.
They didn't want people or churches or businesses. They wanted industry, like factories, in this area.
Is it because the railroad, it was so close to the railroad tracks up here?
It could have been for a host of reasons. It's always been a very highly prized real estate area. Mm-hmm. But whatever it was, they didn't want it in the hands of black people. It was just straight up racism.
It was about 300 businesses and mm-hmm. how many homes that were destroyed?
Oh, 10,000 people lived in the Greenwood District at the time of the race massacre. We had over 24 churches here, schools, banks, theaters, restaurants, you name it. It was a self-contained economy, and they destroyed it.
When the massacre actually happened, did people come into the basement? Like, was there mm-hmm. anybody in the basement? Like,
yeah, one of my oldest members just shared with me that survivors told her that people were actually hiding in the basement.
Survivor accounts of the massacre include eyewitness accounts of bodies being carried on flatbed trucks out of town.
There had been bodies after the massacre that were just dumped. Any open hole, ditch they could find, they just dumped human bodies.
Ultimately, it was a recent article from the Washington Post on the massacre that got Reverend Turner passionate about finding where the bodies are buried.
And in that article, I saw two members of our community, Councilwoman Vanessa Hall Harper and Christy Williams. And so one day the mayor was having one of his community town hall meetings.
He attended a city council meeting in early 2019 and asked Mayor G.T. Bynum about the search for mass graves, as well as reparations for the survivors and their descendants.
And my first time speaking publicly, actually in Tulsa, I stood and began to speak about where I'm from, where I pastor, and I began to talk about what I have learned, an article that I just read, and asking the mayor, you know, about reparations first and foremost, because I heard about the insurance claims not being paid and how people have still not received anything, and about excavating mass graves, because as a pastor, that still offends me, that you have human beings bodies just laying out and have never been, you know, spiritually put to rest. And he said, you know what? Great question. I was just talking about that to my staff today. Long story short, we're going to do it.
The mayor agreed that it was time to think seriously about the possibility of mass graves. So he formed a committee for public oversight.
It was the first time in Tulsa's history that America gone on record saying they're going to excavate mass graves.
There are three major sites that have been targeted as most likely to hold mass graves: New Block Park, Rolling Oak Cemetery, and Oaklawn Cemetery.
It was orchestrated. It wasn't just a group of random guys who just came through Greenwood and just was having a little joyride and killed people. No, this was sanctioned by the city of Tulsa.
Reverend Turner believes it's the city of Tulsa's responsibility to actively bring healing by searching for mass graves and having serious talks about reparations.
And especially these cemeteries, caretakers, they knew where these bodies were because they had to plot around them when you're giving cemetery plots to folks. And so you can't tell me that this whole blank space out here was left blank for no reason. No, it was left blank because the caretakers knew that bodies were dumped out here. So they said, we're not going to sell this to any other family because we don't want them digging up and then we find this massive grave. And so the city has been complicit. All city cemeteries, right? And one of them is actually privately owned now.
The search committee for mass graves has found enough anomalies in the Rolling Oak Cemetery to plan an excavation. However, it is now privately owned. The mayor's decision to search for mass graves was not without pushback.
Pushback, I mean, they tried this about a decade or two ago, and the pushback was, well, you know, if you don't find anything, it's going to hurt your reputation. I said, I can care less about a reputation. We got bodies lying out. You know, because guess what? Even if they don't find something, and I'm almost certain that they will, the fact is, the bodies were still dumped. They were taken somewhere.
Reverend Turner expresses disappointment with the lack of substantive action by the faith leaders in Tulsa.
I think spiritually and morally, Tulsa is only as good as the leaders that they have. I think that Tulsa has been given a pass by a lot of the faith leaders. Even from 1921, preachers co-signed on the massacre. I think the faith leaders really have failed Tulsa in that regard, that there is no real sense of a mandate from the pulpit for repentance, let alone reparations. You know, all they want to talk about is reconciliation. They don't want to talk about repentance or reparations, which is really reparations and reconciliation go hand in hand. You can't have reconciliation without reparations. How can you reconcile? How can you bring back something together when there's still an offense that has not been made right?
While the citizens of Tulsa wait for the city and the owners of Rolling Oaks to come to an agreement on the excavation site, time will continue to march towards the date of the 100-year anniversary when Little Africa burned. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Crystal Patrick.
Allison Eichley Freeman is running for re-election in Oklahoma State Senate District 37. Her district includes parts of Jinx, Sand Springs, and Tulsa. Eichley Freeman was first elected in 2017 during a special election. Bracken Clark has the story.
Allison Eichley Freeman has roots in and connections to many cities in Oklahoma. Her parents are both McLean graduates and are still living in Sperry, where Eichley Freeman spent many of her formative years, moving there from Turley. She now lives in West Tulsa and is raising three children with her wife, Dawn. Two of their children attend school in Tulsa, and one child goes to school in Beggs. Eichley Freeman is white, and her wife is black. I don't think one would find many parents that would say teaching children to talk about race is easy. Eichley Freeman's family has children that identify across racial spectrums, and their marriage is interracial. In a house of differing intersectional identities, this family finds ways to engage in intentional conversations about race that are formational and successful using everyday opportunities, such as who cooks the grits and who makes the oatmeal for breakfast.
Dawn and I moved in together probably 3 years ago. Both of Dawn's boys, the oldest one identifies as black, and the younger absolutely identifies as half white and half black. They have the same father. It's just their own personal identification at this point. And it's really interesting having those conversations in our home. My daughter, who is white, has always lived in highly African-American dense populations. Her first preschool was the 36th Street North Educare, because those are the areas that we've just lived in. And so we really have some interesting conversations in our house about how to talk about race without being offensive. The boys had never really had a lot of those conversations. And so when my daughter would ask questions, they would feel like she was being offensive just in talking about race. They didn't feel comfortable talking about race at all. Now that we're a little farther down the road in our combinedness as a family, there are really interesting discussions. Like, we're beginning to teach them about the race massacre and what that means for them, and talking about the museum that we're going to have and how their interest is in relation to attending that and going through that. Talking about different reactions and how feeling conflicted is okay.
It is not uncommon for a person of a minority group to be asked to speak for everyone belonging to that group, as if that culture is a monolith. I wanted to know if Ikley Freeman was asked to speak for Black culture when people know she has a Black wife.
Thankfully, no. I'm actually super proud of people for not doing that. Double-edged sword, because I also wonder if they're not doing that because they don't care what the Black community thinks about that. Because often I run in circles where people, frankly, just aren't thinking about racial impact, especially in the legislature. You know, we're having conversations about adding racial impact statements to criminal justice bills right now. And that has been a very long conversation. Sometimes I am really excited that people don't ask me to do those things. And sometimes I wish they cared more. So my wife is a massage therapist. People are more likely to ask me how massage therapists feel about a piece of legislation than they are the Black community. I think I genuinely have had more conversations about my wife being a massage therapist than I have racial issues, especially in the legislature.
I wanted to know what her experience is like outside of the legislature, how she and her wife experience being a couple in Tulsa.
People definitely are more willing to engage with me than they are her. So we sit down to dinner, as we often do for a date night. They ask me what I want to drink first, and she kind of just offers. Sometimes they don't even ask her what she wants to drink. They say, "Are you ready?" And they're facing kind of towards me, slightly subtly. And, you know, she just kind of often offers up what she wants to eat. I can't specifically remember a moment where the waiter or waitress has turned to her and said, "And you?" To some degree, like, the bias and the disparities is everywhere here.
For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Bracken Clark.
Richard Baxter, also known as Negro Spiritual 121, is a formerly justice-involved paralegal and activist who has recently embarked on a unique campaign to help North Tulsa residents.
I got sentenced to 121 years, 60 years trafficking ecstasy, 40 years trafficking cocaine, 15 years possession with intent marijuana, 5 years no tax stamp, not paying taxes on the illegal cocaine. Make sure you pay your cocaine tax for everybody listening out there. 1 year paraphernalia for scales and baggies, and 7 days for no insurance on my vehicle. That was in 2009. In 2008, the case was dismissed for illegal search and seizure. So I took a pause so you can soak that in. And so utilizing my power from my story and sharing that gift with my community and having them find their power within so that they can utilize their own power and we can build ourselves up. We got to take care of us. Safety and security, the first platform. I was on Facebook one day and I seen a post from the night before. A female friend of mine had put on there saying, she's really regretting buying a home out north. She hears gunshots every other night. And so when you hear something like that, you normally think, tell that person, call the police. But if we have a distrust for the police and you don't want to call the police, well, who do you call? We need our own private protection agency in our community, and the churches will pay for it. Nobody can argue about safety and security for our community. You know, they don't have to shoulder the entire financial load, but they have to show that they care. If you're operating in that capacity as a church, you're in the community, you should want to protect our people. You should want to make sure they're safe. You should want to make sure that they feel secure, you know, they feel safe. Policing is reactive. If something happens, then I call the police, then they come out. Security is proactive. They're a deterrent. These security officers will be paid by the churches. I have a grant writer to help get some funds in that way, and we're going to get some more financial resources to foot the bill. This model is already being done in another part of town. And so I was able to, when I came up with the idea and I addressed, you know, the powers that be, I found out they're already doing something very similar to this. And they have monthly meetings, monthly check-ins to see if it's working with the private protection agency, with the fire department, with TPD, with the sheriff department, EMSA, and all the business owners and the property owners in that community. You can find me at Negro Spiritual, NegroSpiritual, 121.org, on my Instagram, Negro Spiritual 121.
Continuing our international coverage of intimate partner violence, we explore simple solutions to combat the issue. Here is Christy Eaton reporting from a Somalian region in Ethiopia.
Could discussion over tea help prevent intimate partner violence in refugee settings? That's what two researchers from Harvard University schools are trying to find out. They conducted a study in a refugee camp in the Somali region of Ethiopia. The area is where more than 220,000 refugees reside. More than 2.2 million Somalis are displaced globally. Dr. Vandana Sharma and Dr. Jennifer Scott have created a program called Unite for a Better Life that shares information and creates conversations about intimate partner violence over tea. Sharma says it's a unique concept that builds upon the Somali tradition of oral storytelling involving the beverage.
And so the adopted program, Unite for a Better Life, involves 16 sessions now. And instead of being delivered in the traditional Ethiopian coffee ceremony, which is not implemented within Somali communities, instead it's implemented within tea talks. Somali tea is something that's important culturally among Somalis, and so that was identified as a relevant practice.
Before the program, more than 80% of women reported experiencing physical and or sexual intimate partner violence in their lifetime. At the end of this study, participants improved in knowledge and attitudes regarding intimate partner violence and HIV. A year after the pilot program was complete, one participant said her husband had taken on extra household duties, helping fetch water, which would otherwise be considered a role solely for a woman. This was just one of many stories that came out of the pilot study, which found positive results.
So one, the attendance rates were very high, and so that in and of itself is really important given the context. And we also collected data around participants' opinions of what they learned, whether the program was acceptable or the information was relevant for their lives or useful for their sort of families and homes. And we found that about 92% of the participants were either satisfied or very satisfied with the program.
Sharma hopes the program will help find solutions in a variety of settings and that the pilot research shows there is potential in stemming intimate partner violence.
So our next step is really to test it more rigorously and actually look at violence outcomes to demonstrate its effectiveness.
For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Christy Eaton.
You're listening to Focus Black Oklahoma, a one-hour news and public affairs program on various topics relevant to the Black community statewide. And now, news headlines from across the state. Oklahoma was the last state to declare a state of emergency or public health emergency over COVID-19, which frees up funding for cities and counties. Oklahoma's governor, Kevin Stitt, tweeted last weekend a later deleted photo of himself at a crowded restaurant encouraging healthy young Oklahomans to get outside despite the growing contagion concerns. Mayor Holt of Oklahoma City defended Stitt's post by asserting that the Oklahoma State Health Department had not yet banned gatherings, nor had community spread been confirmed in the state.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed the H.R. 6201 Families First Coronavirus Response Act to allow free testing for those both insured and uninsured, paid emergency sick leave for up to 2 weeks, up to 3 months of paid family and medical leave, expanded federal funding for Medicaid to support local, state, tribal, and territorial governments and health systems, expanded school lunch programs, and enhancements to unemployment benefits. Major chains like Walmart and Starbucks have updated their sick leave policies, while local businesses are hoping to use the benefits of the bill to alleviate losses and layoffs.
As of March 15th, the USDA has granted Oklahoma waivers that will allow sponsors to serve meals to Oklahoma students during school closures. These waivers will ensure students who may experience food insecurity will have access to food while schools deal with the COVID-19 outbreak.
Oklahoma University's Black student leaders ended their 3-day protest last week. The students have stated to more than 100 supporters they are confident the administration will meet their demands after their most recent meeting following the college scandal of a university professor using the N-word.
Governor Kevin Stitt is still in the midst of a conflict with Oklahoma tribal leaders about collecting more profits from tribal casinos. He has threatened to invite commercial casinos to operate within the state. This could possibly destabilize tribal-run gaming facilities. The state received over $138 million from tribal gaming last year. 88% goes to public education.
One of the last living survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre received a special birthday gift this month. Lessie Benningfield Randall will have her home restored at the age of 105. This gift is a result of the work of local community leaders Tiffany Crutcher, founder of the Terrence Crutcher Foundation, District 1 City Councilor Vanessa Hall Harper, and Tony Moore, Executive Director of The Gathering Place. It comes just 1 year before the centennial anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre.
A Newkirk sports announcer has come under fire for comments he made about Crooked Oaks High School girls basketball team. During the player introductions, the announcer said, quote, "Now their names are pretty disgusting, but I'm going to try to call them out," unquote. Crooked Oaks team is primarily made up of students of color. The announcer has since been replaced, and Newkirk has issued a public apology to Crooked Oaks.
An Oklahoma Christian University recruiter has been fired for lining up students based on skin color and hair texture. 11th grade students at Harding Charter Preparatory High School stated that they were first made to line up from lightest skin to darkest skin. Once that line was dispersed, one junior stated, quote, "He told us to line up nappiest hair in the back and straightest hair in the front," unquote. University admissions leadership stated that they did not approve the inappropriate activity in advance and has communicated closely with Harding administration since the visit.
Oklahoma's 2nd Congressional District Republican Representative Mark Wayne Mullen decided to remain silent with a no vote on the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill. Representative Mullen has since posted a public response to his Facebook page stating that he was unable to be present for the vote due to a family medical issue. He stated that if he were in Washington, he would have voted yes on the bill.
One Enid, Oklahoma man is doing his part to preserve the state's Black and white history. Frank Campbell has collected several artifacts over the years that point to Oklahoma's segregated past. Campbell has provided some of the artifacts he's collected, such as whites-only or colored-only drinking fountain signs, to the Railroad Museum of Oklahoma in Enid.
A Claremore math teacher uses her classroom to teach lessons that extend beyond solving equations. Melanie Nagel provides diverse examples of mathematicians so students see themselves reflected in the curriculum. In recognition of Black History Month and Women's Engineering Week, Nagel used Hidden Figures, the 2016 film, and the real-life women it is based on to talk about math, perseverance, and a growth mindset. You're listening to Focus Black Oklahoma, a one-hour news and public affairs program on various topics relevant to the Black community statewide.
And now we have Ritten Quincy, who has the second installment in his series on performing artists in Tulsa, discrimination, and what he calls the Brown Code.
Musically, there's like two worlds in Tulsa. The Tulsa sound, Leon Russell and J.J. Cale and Paul Benjamin. Then there's the soul. The Tulsa sound as well, composed of rhythm and blues, a southern touch of spirit of call and response, and harmonious ballads ushered by a 4- or 6-string chef who sprinkles collard greens and yams over vocals enough to get you out your seat and make your mouth water at the same time. See, the town is cooking with talent like the Gap Band, Four Flavor Kings, and Faye and Bobby Moffitt. The kitchen is ablaze, but not every artist is given the same invitation to the table. Faye and Bobby Moffitt, two of the most talented musical artists this city is fortunate to offer. Friends, hungry.
Matter of fact, they how I mellow down faculties. Saturate the state around because it's so innate. Catch you coming 100 miles per hour from the plate. Still first and second, head first.
Scheduled to appear at this year's South by Southwest before its cancellation, they share some of their sentiments about their experiences.
I don't remember the name.
Okay.
I just know it was, what, 81st and Mingo somewhere.
Okay.
We went out there because it was through a booking agency. I had tried a booking agency for the first time. And they brought me out to this place, and they were the rudest people ever. Now, I don't know, you know, I had never played there before, so I didn't know what type of crowd it was or anything. I just came prepared to do what I came to do.
And which
we
which
gave
was?
Them like a list of stuff that we were going to be doing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So they know you're coming out there to do soul and R&B. I don't think it was more so the music. I think it was more so, you know, it was an all Black band. We brought our people out there, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was majority white people. Now this was a long time ago, but again,
long time
you know,
ago, like how long?
This had to have been 6 years ago.
In the span of an artist's performance tenure, 6 years is a while. But just 6 years ago.
So do you think it had to do with the fact that you all were Black?
I do feel like there was some intimidation by the fact that we were in there Black. Mm-hmm. And they probably thought, you know, we were a cliche Black band that was gonna bring probably a whole slew of Black folks. Mm-hmm. And they didn't feel like dealing with it, you know.
Okay.
So that's the type of vibe.
Bobby continues from his perspective.
They definitely were kind of, this isn't what we expected, or this isn't what, you know, we were really prepared to, like, and when I say that, I mean, like, the music, the performance, just everything that we brought, you know.
The entire package.
The entire package.
Yeah.
Faye and Bobby get the impression that they are paid less. They are not sure.
But they do get the opportunities that I feel like are exposed on a greater scale.
Right. They're getting to play at venues that have a way bigger audience and crowd that can hear your music, you know what I'm saying?
And they're local as well.
They're local as well.
And all the work that I've done in Tulsa for a very long time. You know, I've never been asked to be on the news channel in the morning. You know, people reach out to me, I think by chance. Some people just, you know, dig what I'm doing, apparently, and want me to be a part of it. But I feel like my, you know, all my stuff, my package is packaged well, and it's up to par, and it's impactful. But, you know, there's certain opportunities that haven't come to me, and sometimes I'm wondering, why haven't I been hit up, you know, mm-hmm. for whatever reason that may be.
Finally, there's the decision. The decision on how to address the feeling. The feeling of, is this discrimination? And what will you do with it?
Makes me feel like I have to go 10, 20 times harder and work 10, 20 times harder as anybody else to be heard and to, you know, to put a lot of money and time and effort into making this polished project so everybody can hear it and understand it and feel it. It makes me feel alienated from the, you know, like the general circle in Tulsa.
Right.
So, but I capitalize on those areas that I know I have strength in and support.
Yeah, any type of Tulsa-based musical event, you know, the bands and people that they're reaching out to for a lot of these festivals and things that are going on that are Tulsa production, you know, they don't give our genre the recognition. And I'm speaking for the whole genre, you know, right. Not yeah. just us, but just,
I think it's fair that you can speak for the time that you put in, but go ahead.
You know what I mean? Because we've had to create our own little subculture underneath that that's still going to thrive and still going to do its thing, but we should still be able to be in those brackets, you know what I'm saying, with those people that represent our state, represent our town, represent our area code. Mm-hmm. We should be able to be up there right there with them.
With Focus Black Oklahoma, Redden Quincy.
Just Mercy is a film and number one best-selling true story of a man who was wrongly convicted and incarcerated in 1980s Alabama. Focus Black Oklahoma film reviewer Devin Williams has our review.
Is it justice to sentence someone to death? It has been well documented that since 1973, over 165 people who were wrongly convicted and sentenced to death have been exonerated. Does that cause you any concern? What if I told you that even when guilt is proven beyond reasonable doubt, the lives of the convicted still have value and they don't deserve to die? Just Mercy is a recent feature film that challenges us to take a long, hard look at the death penalty and those who are sentenced to die. Just Mercy explores the life of wrongfully convicted survivor Walter McMillan, portrayed by Jamie Foxx. McMillan is an innocent man who lost 6 precious years of his life on death row. Just Mercy explores the relationships he had with people both in and out of prison, all the people who fought tirelessly to secure his freedom, and all the forces that conspired to condemn an innocent human being to death. Just Mercy thoroughly explores racism in 1994 Alabama, emotionally illustrates the humanity of death row inmates, and questions the credibility of the American judicial system and the validity of the death penalty. Destin Daniel Critton, the director of Just Mercy, expertly utilizes his all-star cast. This real-life story has a script that is methodical, complex, and emotional to force the audience to walk each treacherous step that Brian Stevenson took to found the Equal Justice Initiative, or EJI. There are 3 performances that stand out above all the rest. First, the always excellent Michael B. Jordan, who portrays Brian Stevenson with passion, vigor, and grit. Secondly, Rob Morgan's ability to make you sympathize with his character, Herbert Richardson, a Vietnam vet with PTSD who died via electrocution for the murder of a young girl, will leave you fractured. Last but not least, Oklahoma's Tim Blake Nelson's enigmatic performance as Ralph Myers is a dialogue-destroying, scene-chewing juggernaut. He may have only about 10 minutes of screen time, but you will be captivated by every second he is present. From the opening scene, the hostility is palpable. The film illustrates all the corruption, racism, and despair associated with the story, while remaining sensitive and understanding of the most dastardly of characters. The film's greatest strength is its ability to humanize the most demonized members of our society, Black men on death row. Death row inmates have long been the blood sacrifice in the name of justice, a way to balance the scales justified by the most heinous of crimes, which, of course, is to take another human life. However, Just Mercy asks the questions that are oftentimes not even considered, like, what happens if a person is sentenced to death, but they did not have the competent legal counsel that is promised in our Constitution? In the film, Stevenson is interviewing and reviewing the cases of death row inmates. There is a montage of the effectively dead men speaking of the dubious circumstances of their convictions. Many explain that their lawyers never met with them or discussed the details of their cases. Disturbingly, some said their lawyers explained that there was nothing that could be done for them. For me, the biggest question this film poses is the death penalty moral? Should an eye for an eye be the law of the land, or does it leave justice blind to mercy and compassion? In the film, there is a scene where McMillan is comforting Herbert. Herbert says, "I deserve to die for what I did." McMillan responds, "Just because you killed somebody doesn't give them the right to kill you back. Just mercy isn't only about systemic racism in the criminal justice system. It's about compassion, integrity, truth, redemption, hope, faith, and action. The end of the film celebrates the many victories of the EJI. It shows other people who were falsely convicted being freed from prison, some serving as many as 30 years before tasting freedom again. It has pictures of McMillan with his family and friends, and closes with the expected "Where Are They Now?" steals with captions. However, its final caption is a shocking statistic that I will not share here. You will see it once you've seen the film. It's a call to action and a reminder that this kind of injustice is far too commonplace, and it will take us all to fix it. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Devin Williams.
Focus Black Oklahoma is produced in partnership by Public Radio Tulsa, the Tulsa Artist Fellowship, and Tri-City Collective, and is broadcast from the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. Our theme music is by Moffitt Music. Our contributing music artist on this broadcast is Malachi Burgess, available under Mally Motives on all streaming sites. Additional music is contributed by Two Piece. Search for him at musicmanent.com. The executive producers of Focus Black Oklahoma are Quraysh Ali Lansana and Scott Gregory. The associate producers are Bracken Clark and Ali Shaw. Visit us online at tricitycollective.com/FBO and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Focus Black OK.